Hi, I'm Bill Kristol. Welcome to Conversations. I'm very glad to be joined today by Paul Cantor, professor of English at the University of Virginia, and a previous conversant.
Yes, it's great to be back.
Whatever the right term is there,
right? Great to be back. Interlocutor.
Interlocutor, right. We've discussed Shakespeare. We've discussed popular culture. People should go watch those conversations, in my opinion. They're very good ones. But I thought today, when I called you up on this, I asked, why don't you tell someone like me who doesn't do nearly enough reading of good books what I should read, and tell everyone out there books they should read, maybe books they wouldn't automatically think of. You changed the assignment a little bit.
Well, I was a little worried about just talking about books in general, because there'd be an awful long list then. But I thought I'd talk about works of literature, plays, novels, some short stories, that support liberty, that teach us something important about liberty and freedom.
And that's kind of a contrarian notion, since I think people assume that much of literature, you know, is the adversary culture, hostile to liberty, at least to economic liberty,
and
maybe an old-fashioned political liberty is not a, you know.
Yeah, and there's some truth to that. I have certain ways of accounting for it. One of them is that since the market economy developed, a lot of authors are hostile to it. Now, they're very mistaken. They don't appreciate how much the market economy has done for literature. In fact, more people have been able to earn livings writing literature since the market economy developed. But the problem is they are rewarded, but in their view, they're not rewarded enough.
Right.
And the frustration to them is to see, yeah, I'm making a decent living writing novels, but Stephen King is making so much more money than I am. And I think this is a problem with authors, that they have high opinions of themselves and they think the market must be bad because it doesn't sufficiently reward their merit. The other thing that I, this is an interesting theory I came up with in an essay I wrote about H.G. Wells, authors don't give freedom to their characters. They are used to running a little world.
Central planning.
The act of writing a novel is an act of central planning. It's why many authors are attracted to the notion, well, society should be run that way. People shouldn't be allowed to do whatever they want to do. I wrote this up in an essay on H.G. Wells' Invisible Man, where there's this strange moment when he admits to losing sight of his main character. He's very frustrated. What happened at that point, Invisible Man? Nobody knows to this day. And I realized, you know, this is frustrating to an author. They are used to their characters following the script. And so it's almost an occupational hazard of being an author to be disposed towards central planning. But today we're going to look at several authors who are free of that prejudice.
Okay, so this is great works of literature, free of the prejudice, free of anti-liberal prejudice, right?
Yes.
Liberal in the old-fashioned sense.
Yes, in the old-fashioned sense,
economic
indeed.
And political liberal. So,
okay, I'm going to begin with maybe the most extraordinary of the works. It's a play by Ben Jonson. It's called Bartholomew Fair. Dates from around 1614. Ben Jonson was a contemporary of William Shakespeare. What a sad thing to be. I mean, Ben Jonson is a great, great playwright, but he was only the second greatest playwright of his day. And he's famous for his comedies, plays called The Alchemist and Volpone, which are very much still produced today and very funny. This play is less well known. It's actually a little hard to stage because it has such a large cast of characters. It is fantastic when it's staged. I've been lucky to see it twice. I looked on YouTube. I wish I could recommend something that's available of a production, but I couldn't find one. Anyway, it's about a fair. It's about Bartholomew Fair. It was a real fair.
Just a real fair.
Just a real
in
fair.
London, is that right?
Just outside London. Yeah. And I like to call the play the Seinfeld of the Renaissance. It's the play about nothing. It's a play about a group of people who go to a fair, mill around, look at various goods, buy things, get into trouble, and then go home. It's as close to a slice of life as you'll get in any drama before the 19th century. I will confess it's a little hard to read for that reason. It takes a while to get into it. By the way, it's all in prose. And if you think Shakespeare's poetry is hard to read, it actually is easier to read than someone who's just reproducing the prose of the time. But it's worth the effort. It is literally a representation of a market. And Johnson shows these ordinary people going to the fair. And at first, it seems anti-market. It's almost the cliche of what's wrong with markets. The market, Bartholomew's Fair, is full of cheats. And they are adulterating their tobacco, mixing it in with some other stuff. They're giving instructions to the barkeeps, shake up the beer so the foam comes up, and they think they're getting more. And the cradler, they tell again the waiters, you know, get the bottles off while they're still half full, and we'll serve them more. And so we see all the complaints about the market, that the businessmen cheat their customers. There are prostitutes at the fair. We constantly see people buying things they don't need, silly toys and so on. And you'd think at first it's all about what's wrong with marketplaces. But what Johnson deals with is the people who want to regulate the marketplace. And what he shows is they're worse than the thieves and the con men at the market. And I actually think of this play as the first defense of a free market in literature, and quite frankly, one of the first defenses of the free market anywhere.
Wow.
And it's based on the idea.
So that's
of,
pretty early, 1614.
Yeah,
it's before
the
political philosophers we think of as.
Yes, there are the Spanish scholastics, the School of Salamanca, which were defending the free market, but not too many people have heard of them. What it deals with is the problem of regulation. And there are two main would-be regulators. One is a Puritan. He has the marvelous Puritan name of Zeal of the Land Busy. And to him, the market is the site of iniquity, sinfulness. It must be shut down. And he tries to destroy some of the little shops at the fair. And what Johnson exposes is the guy's a hypocrite. Because he's complaining about all these things at the fair, but he seems to know a lot about it. And for example, he's not supposed to be eating pork as a Puritan. Evidently, they went back to the Old Testament prohibitions. But he loves a pork sandwich, and he comes up with some sophisticated argument about why he must encounter the evils of the pork sellers to be able to deal with them. And then he munches down to his delight. And you begin to see where the source of Johnson's sympathy for the market is, because the Puritans wanted to shut down the commercial theaters. So one thing Johnson understood was people who regulate markets regulate theaters and would put them out of business. And so actually the play builds up to a hilarious scene. There's a puppet show at the theater, and they're doing a play that's almost as bad as Pyramus and Thisbe in A Midsummer Night's Dream. It's about Hero and Leander. One of the main arguments the Puritans raised against the theater was cross-dressing. As you may know, women, there were no actresses. Men dressed, boys dressed up as women and staged in Shakespeare's play. And so the Zeal of the Land Busy gets up and curses these cross-dressing actors. And of course, it's a puppet show. And at the climactic moment, the puppet pulls up its dress, and there's no private parts there. And so he says, look, I'm neither male nor female. And this is a great, embarrassing moment for Zeal of the Land Busy. And again, it's what Johnson is showing is these regulators are no better than the people they're trying to regulate. They have their own self-interest. And they're just trying to spoil fun. And it's Johnson wrote to entertain an audience, and in a sense he concludes markets are there to make people happy, and what's wrong with that? Now, the even more interesting character is a kind of justice of the peace named Adam Overdue, and that name is a clue he sees all the illegal acts going on at the fair, and he wants to regulate it. And I'm just there's one passage that is so fascinating, I've got to read it to you, because he's imagining what we need for this fair. He's looking for a guy to regulate, and he says, never shall I enough commend a worthy, worshipful man, sometime a capital member of the city, for his high wisdom in this point, who would take you now the habit of a porter. now of a carman, now of a dog killer in this month of August, and in the winter of a seller of tinderboxes, he wants undercover agents at the fair. They'll dress up as if they're participants of the fair. And what would he do in all these shapes? Marry. Go you into every alehouse and down into every cellar. Measure the length of puddings. Take the gauge of black pots and cans, iron custards with a stick, and their circumference with a thread. Weigh the loaves of bread on his middle finger. Then would he send from home. We're gonna check out every dimension of every item at the fair. He'd punish them and give the puddings to the poor, the bread to the hungry, the custards to his children, break the pots and burn the cans himself. He would not trust his corrupt officers. He would do it himself. Would all men in authority would follow this worthy precedent? For alas, as we are public persons, what do we know? That should be on every government regulatory agency as a motto. Nay, what can we know? We hear with other men's ears. We see with other men's eyes. A foolish constable or a sleepy watchman is all our information. And that, I claim, is Friedrich Hayek.
Yeah, that's amazing.
It's absolutely amazing. The problem of knowledge, that the reason you can't have regulation is it's too detailed. And you would have to be every man himself. Yeah. He says, it would undo the division of labor. You would have a core of regulators which would outnumber the actual producers. It's an amazing passage to make it a problem of knowledge. And, in light of all the controversy about the EU, these Brussels regulations, right. The curve of the banana gets specified. Here, Johnson anticipates that idea as early as 1614.
So it's not just anti-clericalism or anti-Puritanism, which would lead you in a liberal direction, presumably.
It's a sort of more
of a critique of central planning and a sort of...
Yeah, it is a...
Even for word religiously...
It's a defense of the marketplace, the dispersal of knowledge. And the other thing, what's quite amazing, is that the fair, it's corrupt, but it's innocent and nobody gets hurt. But both Overdue and Zila Land Busy start hurting people. They tear down businesses. They get into fights. There's a guy named Humphrey Wasp in it, too. And amazingly, Johnson anticipates the English Civil Wars of the 1640s. That he sees that, the market has its problems, but it's not violent. It's a way of bringing people together to satisfy their desires. And there are these other forces, this waspishness, this Puritan intolerance. He sensed this is going to break the peace. And, 30 years after this play, England's plunged into civil war by characters like Adam Overdue and Zila Land Busy.
Yeah, 1614 is amazing. I mean, I guess Shakespeare has the critique of Puritanism, certainly.
Yes, in Twelfth Night.
And Measure for Measure, I guess.
But
not so much the market, the appreciation of the market? I mean, is that...
There's a bit of it in Merchant of Venice, where the objection to converting Jews is it will raise the price of pork.
Right.
It's one of the first formulations of the law of supply and demand in literature. But I think Johnson is... ahead of Shakespeare on this issue. Part of the reason is that Johnson sees the correspondence between the spirit of the market and spirit of comedy. Generally, comedy is in defense of human desires. It's all about spoil sports, killjoys, people who stand in the way of people enjoying life, and that's the spirit of the market as well. But particularly the defense of the market here against an overzealous religious attitude and an overzealous political attitude. In all honesty, Johnson never wrote anything quite like this, though there are elements of this in his play, The Alchemist, as well. But it really is remarkable.
Great. Well, it's good to have a recommendation or something. I had never heard of it. I actually seen one or two Johnson plays put on here in Washington, and they are funny and seem more conventionally
Yes, this is a very
comic, as you said. Yeah, you're making fun of the, you know.
Yeah, this is a very unconventional play, and it's absolutely brilliant. There's this great character in it called Ursula the Pig Woman, who is usually played by a man. And my dream would have been to see John Belushi play Ursula the Pig Woman, but we'll never get to see that, alas.
Sad facts, right? Okay, next, once we've read this play.
Next on my list is Daniel Defoe's A Journal of the Plague Year, which is the first zombie novel. It is a novel about The Walking Dead. Now, it is presented as a straightforward non-fictional account of the Great London Plague of 1665.
And Defoe writes in...
It's written 1721.
So he's early 18th, so a whole century after Johnson, right?
Yeah. And he was born, I think, in 1660, so he had actually experienced the plague as a child. This is very early in the history of the novel, really, and the line between fiction and nonfiction was not clearly drawn. Most people thought Robinson Crusoe was a true account when he wrote that. And in this case, as well, it looks like a true account, somewhat fictionalized. It's quite literally about the Walking Dead. It's about bubonic plague in London, if that's what it is. I guess that's the best guess. What's interesting about Defoe, history of the novel, is he really is reacting to the new individualism that comes with Hobbes and Locke and the study of the individual in isolation. That, after all, is what Robinson Crusoe is. So in the case of Robinson Crusoe, he's dealing with something that's obviously the state of nature. But in Journal of the Plague Year, he figured out how to recreate the state of nature in London. That's what the plague did. It made people suddenly islands unto themselves, trying to isolate themselves from the plague. And it particularly shows how the division of labor breaks down under the plague situations, where people can't trade as easily with each other. So it becomes a kind of narrative of survival. We talked about the TV show Walking Dead last time I was here. In many ways, this show explores the same issues as The Walking Dead does, and in particular, the issue of how the government responded to the plague. And whether government intervention, here we go again, whether government intervention was the proper response to the plague. Now here, Defoe, I think, very legitimately airs both sides of the debate without acknowledging the contradiction. Sometimes he says the government did a great job with the plague, and sometimes it shows it didn't do such a great job. Now, this was based in a curious fact of Daniel Defoe. He was in many ways the first political journalist in the modern sense, but he wrote for both parties. He wrote for the Whigs, he wrote for the Tories. There are evidently crazy situations where he's writing editorials against himself. He'll publish something in favor of the Whigs, then he'll write a Tory argument against it. He was just trying to sell articles to newspapers. And there is this fascinating correlation between the rise of newspapers and the development of the novel. And you know, Defoe was the Tom Wolfe of his day, a journalist who wrote novels. On the one hand, he does say the government did a great job, that they came in, they set up watches, they quarantined the city, they tried to confine people to their quarters, and offers a really positive image of the government's supervision of the situation. Should point out that it's the civic government of London, though, the municipal government. He's very hard on the royal family and the court that they deserted the city to protect themselves. And you do see something of the Puritan middle-class background of Daniel Defoe, that what he's defending is the middle-class authorities and how they handle it. But counter to that is, again, a kind of Hayekian argument of the unintended consequences of the supervision. That, for example, because houses were being shut down, and people isolated. A lot of people didn't report the plague. He also makes the point that maybe the best way of dealing with a plague is not to confine hundreds of thousands of people to a limited area and let it spread. Now, of course, people didn't understand the cause of the plague then, but they suspected it had something to do with being near so many other people. And then he points out, again, it's akin to Ben Johnson, he points out that they didn't have enough knowledge. It was impossible to supervise the whole city. And so in many cases, they were acting on the wrong information. And then he makes, again, what would be a very contemporary point, that this looks great in theory, but many of the guardians were bribed. And that you set up this watch system, and then people just bought their way out. And also, he makes the argument and presents very positively the people who fled. That they were escaping the plague, not spreading it, and there's an interesting dialectic in the book between the government attempt to keep everybody in place and the human impulse towards freedom and moving on and getting away from the problem. So it explores many of the issues that a show like The Walking Dead does. Does the government help the situation or actually make it worse? So I think it's fascinating to read for that reason.
So we have two English authors then who are sort of, yes, Hayekians, centuries ahead of Hayek. That's impressive. But you sort of expect that maybe from the English tradition, the British tradition, that they would have some feel for the case for liberty.
Yes, yes. And again, particularly Defoe.
Yeah.
Who was basically a Whig, although he would write for the Tory press if there was money in it.
Okay, so we've read Johnson, we've read Defoe.
Okay, we're going over to Germany now, or at least there was no Germany at the time I'm talking about, but the German lands. A German playwright named Georg Büchner. That's Buckner to Americans, B-U umlaut, but Georg Büchner. He's a fascinating case. Died at the age of 24.
Is that right?
If Shakespeare had died at the age of 24, we never would have heard of him. Shakespeare apparently wrote his first play when he was 25. Büchner was on his way maybe to being the greatest dramatist ever. No one, even Hugo von Hofmannsthal, ever wrote such great dramas at that age.
Now, when is this?
1830s. He died in 1837.
And what did he die of? Just a disease of some kind?
I think it was some kind of disease, although evidently his health wasn't that good. He wrote, we have three plays. He wrote a fourth play that's been lost. One of the three plays that we have is Woyzeck, which was made into a movie by Werner Herzog, starring Klaus Kinski, I think in the 1990s. The only way I can express this is to say that Georg Büchner wrote a screenplay for a 1990s movie in 1835.
Wow.
In fact, none of his plays were produced during his lifetime. His plays were not produced until the 20th century. This play, Woyzeck, became Alban Berg's opera, Woyzeck, because they couldn't read Büchner's handwriting originally. And, you know, one of the greatest operas of the 20th century, again, the libretto was written in the 1830s. It is one of the most amazing cases in literary history. Talk about a man born before his time.
Right.
He was writing 20th century literature in the 1830s. No one knew who he was in the 19th century. His plays were enormously influential on 20th century drama. People like Brecht, for example. I want to talk about his play called Danton's Death. Most people think of Woyzeck as his greatest play, and there's much to be said for that, but I actually think Danton's Death is greater and more important. It's a play about the French Revolution. It's largely about the conflict between Danton and Robespierre. And I like to see it as the conflict between two sides of Rousseau. And Rousseau actually comes up in the play. Buchner's trying to understand why the French Revolution went wrong. The French Revolution was potentially the greatest subject for 19th century literature. I always laugh when people sit around and say, well, we have no great subjects anymore in the 19th century. Well, the French Revolution was as dramatic event in world history as any. And Buchner is really the only one I know of who does full dramatic justice to it. And what he shows is the ideological conflict at the heart of the revolution, and it's the conflict between liberty and equality. And he takes what we'll call the social contract side of Rousseau. Now, there's a side of Rousseau who's arguing for community, return to the model of Sparta, the general will, the emphasis on participate in the community. And Buchner shows that that's what Robespierre stood for in the French Revolution. Danton stands for the other side of Rousseau, the Rousseau you'd find in his Reveries of a Solitary Walker, in his Confessions, in all his personal writings, where he talks about his own life, where he speaks in favor of a radical freedom, which he sees as the only way of recapturing the state of nature. This famous moment when he says, I think it's in the Confessions, where he says, I couldn't make love if I was ordered to do it. Mm-hmm. You know, even the most pleasurable experience I couldn't enjoy if it was under compulsion. And that's what Danton represents in the play, the libertine aspect. And it really shapes up as the political conflict, the personal conflict between the two. And it's really interesting because what Buchner understands is liberty, equality, fraternity, those don't go together that easily. And in particular, he shows the conflict between liberty and equality, that Robespierre stands for equality. And it's quite explicit in the play that we will drag people down to the level where they'll then be equal. And the objection to Danton's actually a classical liberal. He's in favor of liberty in all aspects of life, and the result is some people will get wealthier than others, and Robespierre is very much the man of the people. The people love him for that reason, whereas they're very suspicious of Danton. They think he's a new aristocrat. So that's how Robespierre is able to defeat Danton, and you know, Danton's death. It ends with Robespierre's triumph. Of course, we know Robespierre will fall too, but it's really a wonderfully perceptive illustration of the way revolutions destroy their own, eat up their own. You know, this is the 1830s. It's not that long after the event, and I think he saw how the French Revolution was going to become the prototype of revolutions later. Now, Buchner himself was a revolutionary. By the way, he was a medical doctor. He had a doctorate in medicine. I mean, it's all age 24, but he'd also he wrote something called the we'd say the Hessian Courier. In English, he had a revolutionary newspaper trying to stir up people against the aristocrats, and yet part of him saw how dangerous that was. And we said, there's one sequence, wonderful sequence in the play where some poor guy, they want to rename his daughter. Cornelia, as you may know, the French Revolution loved to rename things.
Right.
Notre Dame became the Temple of Reason, they adopted Roman names. And this guy, he just, you know, it's his daughter, and he wants to name her, and the crowd wants this nice Roman name, and he refers to her as his daughter, and say, oh no, she's the daughter of the Republic, and it really, you know, gets to the sort of stuff that produced names like Lenin and Stalin and so on. It's an amazingly perceptive work, and really raises a fundamental question that we're still dealing with, you know, what is the trade-off between liberty and equality?
That sounds great. I've got to admit, I've never heard of him or of the place.
It is staged.
It's translated into English.
Oh, yes, yes. Many translations. I've seen it in London.
Uh-huh.
A production of it by Max Reinhardt in 1912 changed the course of 20th century theater. It required radically new methods of production. And from that, so much of 20th century stagecraft developed, because Max Reinhardt was this very great stager in the German theater.
Okay, well, that sounds great. French Revolution. Well, French Revolution was a huge topic, though, then. I mean, already,
yeah,
obviously.
But, you know, it's...
Hegel and,
yeah, but efforts to represent it in literature have not turned out that
Napoleon
well.
Was represented in literature,
yeah,
obviously.
There's some questions of how well that was done. So,
yeah.
It's a remarkable political play. Maybe the best political play of the 19th century. By the way, it has a strong Shakespearean element in it. There is comic relief in it, for example. Mm. Shakespeare was his model.
Oh, is that right?
For it. Yes,
wow.
Yes.
Wow.
Because Shakespeare was very popular in Germany
right.
then. And so it's in some ways the most Shakespearean play of the 19th century. Because he's dealing with the same issues. And one of the great issues in it is whether history makes human beings or human beings make history. The characters fight back and forth on this. They realize that if men make history, that's not very democratic. It's the great man theory. And so Robespierre represents the principle no man is indispensable to the revolution. Dante insists, I am.
Mm-hmm.
I made this revolution. And that's what turns the crowd against him. So it really deals with it's a great play.
Good. I'm glad to have learned about of the play and of the author. I have to go look at those. I wasn't aware that was the origin. I've heard, obviously, I know a tiny bit about the Berg opera, but I didn't know that was the origin of it either.
Yeah.
And it's really just the play. I mean, it's not.
Yes,
like, it's not turned much into a libretto.
You know, it is. Büchner did not finish it, and so there were four versions. Modern authors have the liberty of choosing scenes, so that, for example, the sequence of scenes in the Berg opera is different from the generally accepted version of the play, and similarly in Herzog's film, the play does work in Wojtek in any order, because it's a play about a madman, and part of it is about the disintegration of his mind. So that the scenes follow each other in different order. That works very well.
Can you recommend the movie?
The movie is stunning. I mean, it is perhaps Klaus Kinski's greatest performance, and that's saying a lot. Of course, playing a madman was not much of a stretch for Klaus Kinski.
So you tune in here for literary recommendations. You get movies thrown in,
yeah.
And TV shows too, The Walking
yeah.
Dead. So of
yeah.
course, we expect no less from you. Okay, back to Britain now.
Yeah, we're going to go back to Britain now to a novel that I think dates from 1854, Elizabeth Gaskell's North and South. Now, Elizabeth Gaskell is at the very top of the second rank of Victorian novelists, or I would even say at the very bottom of the first rank. There's, I don't know how many Americans have heard of her. She's very well known in England. The book I'm going to discuss is called North and South. That was made into a miniseries in England. Wives and Daughters was made into a miniseries. Let's say she's just below the rank of the Bronte sisters and George Eliot, but she was a very successful novelist at the time, and certainly one of the top 10 novelists of the 19th century in Britain. What's interesting about this book is it defends the Industrial Revolution, and it defends women working in factories.
Yeah.
And this is so counter to what we think of. It's an amazing book. If you like Victorian novels, you will like this. It's a love story, but a different kind of love story. It's not autobiographical, but it parallels Elizabeth Gaskell's experience to this extent. She moved to Manchester from the south of England. Manchester, as you may know, was the ground zero of the Industrial Revolution. It was a great center of the cotton mills. And everybody's example of what was wrong with the Industrial Revolution, the pollution, the noise, and she hated it when she got there. And her first novels, Mary Barton, was very successful, and it attacked the cotton business. And this did not sit well with her neighbors in Manchester. And moreover, as she got to know the place, she began to understand it and to appreciate the energy of it, the industriousness of the industry. She came from really the world of Jane Austen, from the rural south of England, and her heroine, Margaret Hale, comes from there, and she's from an upper-class family, not a wealthy upper-class family, but upper-class, and as a young woman, as she puts it, Margaret doesn't like shoppy people. Her mother is trying to set her up with some, oh, he's a shoppy person, he's in trade. And you get all the, you know, her father's a clergyman, she lives in the world of gentlemen and gentlewomen, and she's a very decent person, a lot of noblesse oblige. She's helping out the poor people back home in the South. And then she comes up to the North and all the noise, the dirt, the smoke. her first vision, it's called Milton Northern in the novel, but it's Manchester. First vision of Manchester, she can't see it. But she falls in love with a cotton baron, John Thornton. And she begins to appreciate that this guy accomplishes something, that he produces something. And she starts to notice that people aren't lazy in Manchester, that back home in the South, they sat around and did nothing, and especially did nothing for themselves. And up here in the North, the people are working hard, they're producing things. And it's particularly interesting, she sees these women working in the factories, and they're whistling while they work. When they come home, they're happy, they're jovial. They don't pay a sufficient respect to her. She can't. These people, they seem independent. They back home, everybody deferred to her. Oh, Miss Margaret. But up there, they don't care who she is. And the other thing the family notices, they can't get servants. They're used to having servants, and no one answers their ads. She finally talks to some women about it, and they like working in the factory. Why? Because they're paid money, and they can decide what to do with. The servant jobs were basically room and board jobs. Mm-hmm. You worked as a servant, and then we won't go into all the problems that, because Elizabeth Gaskell wasn't going to the sexual issues, that what it meant when you worked for some master right. in a household, but it's clear the women tell Margaret Hale they like the independence of it. They like, well, I'm going to say 9 to 5, but maybe it was 8 to 7. But they like the fact that they can leave the job at the office or in the factory. That they're not 24/7 subject to someone's will. They like the fact that they're not paid in kind, but in money that they can spend on their own. So this is, again, these things that we think of as the nightmare of Victorian England, women worked in factories. Turns out, and this is that the women made a conscious choice to work in factories, that in fact, the laws passed against women working in factories were generated by male labor unions who were trying to keep the work for men. Women were not allowed to testify at the parliamentary hearings on these new laws, and people like Elizabeth Gaskell resented. Why? Because, again, the market had been very good to her. Here was a profession that women were able to compete with equally. And it is the 19th century commercial British novel was the first artistic area in which women were able to compete as equals with men, and they not only held their own, they blew away the competition.
Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah. Just think of the famous 19th century British novelists.
And this was not
from
lost.
Austin through
this was not
Elliot.
Lost. Not lost on the men, who complained about it. If they could have banned women from writing, they would have. But the interesting thing, the women now it's Mary Barton was published anonymously. But once it was a success, everyone wanted the author of Mary Barton, and she could reveal her identity. And considering Dickens was her patron, that is, North and South was published serially in Dickens magazine, Household Words. And Dickens actually didn't like her, and he thought of her as a rival. Suddenly, everybody's talking Mary Barton now, and his clever idea is, I'm getting her to work for me, she'll write for my magazine. And they had lots of arguments, actually. Dickens was actually writing Hard Times, his anti-industrial novel, and at the same time, and they were being serialized with North and South a little behind. And North and South is actually a kind of ongoing critique of Hard Times.
Wow.
It's a fascinating dialogue going on there. So Elizabeth Gaskell experienced, it's nice to be a working woman.
Right.
It's quite remarkable how she was able to see that projected onto the situation of these factory women. And the other thing is, the great thing about the novel, in my view, is it is a critique of agricultural labor. We have these weird fantasies about the 19th century that factory work was so horrible. And it was horrible, but we're comparing it with life today. We don't see that what the practical alternative to factory life was working on farms.
Or being a servant, I suppose.
Yeah, being a servant or working on farms. And the novel is very strong about how horrible it was to work on an English farm in the 19th century. We think of it as gardening.
Right.
Oh, you're outdoors. Well, be outdoors in an English fall and spring in northern England. And several of the characters are farmers. And then several of the laborers in the north want to go south. They say, you made the south sound so good. She keeps defending the south even as she comes to appreciate the north. And then finally, one of the laborers who she likes is going to move down south to work on a farm, and she has to confess, you wouldn't last 1 week. You'll die in that weather. And again, it is, we have this myth of English factory life as if it was Mao and the Great Leap Forward, that people were forcing the English people into factories. This was voluntary. Today there are many wonderful alternatives to work in factories. The alternatives then were servant or farm labor. What Gaskell shows in this novel is farm labor was horrible. By the way, read Thomas Hardy's Tess and the D'Urbervilles if you want to see how horrible it was. And the other thing that she shows it was soul-destroying, that it was brutalizing. You worked 12 hours in the field, you came home and just wanted to collapse. And she shows in the city in Manchester, people go to pubs and they talk. And again, it's a bit of an idealization of it, but we need to undo this pattern of idealizing farm work and demonizing factory work. This novel is very unusual in that it does that.
Now, in the 20th century, one thinks of literary figures, artists, and so forth, particularly being enamored of different despotisms, obviously communism, but fascism too, and Nazi, you know, even collaborating with Nazis and so forth. Not being big defenders of liberal democracy, I'd say, on the whole.
Yeah.
But is that correct? I mean, I think that's...
It is correct, largely. It's really actually a shameful record of many authors of the 20th century. But they often feel an affinity with dictators, as little dictators themselves. And quite frankly, a lot of great artists were seduced by dictators, Hitler, Stalin, Castro, so on, that these people seem to respect them and promote them, and so on. It's been a kind of devil's bargain. But
there's art friendly to liberty in the 20th century.
Yes, and also hostile to tyranny. And those are the ones I'm going to discuss. Let me begin with Joseph Conrad, who was born Joseph Teodor Yosef Konrad Korzianowski, a Pole during a period when Poland was ruled by the Russian Tsar, and Konrad's parents actually were freedom fighters for Poland. One reason he ended up fleeing the country, which wasn't a separate country at the time. But anyway, I want to talk about his novel, The Secret Agent, which dates from 1907. Again, one of these remarkable works. You can't believe it was written when it was done. It is a great novel about terrorism, and particularly about the strange double, triple world of espionage, counter-espionage, terrorism, counter-terrorism. It's based on a true incident. It was an attempt to blow up Greenwich Observatory. You know, that's where the prime meridian is, right. Greenwich Mean Time. It's where, and this would just be a real classic terrorist act, the kind of thing we're living with today. What turned out to be so odd about it is it was planned and financed by a foreign government that wanted to stage a left-wing anarchist terror incident. Because Britain in the 19th century, this amazingly liberal society in the old sense, was a safe haven for anarchists, communists, various left-wing forces from all over Europe, people like Mikhail Bakunin and Alexander Herzen, we'll be talking about them maybe in a little while.
Karl Marx himself.
Karl Marx, of course, the greatest example. These people who participated in the 1848 revolution and were persona non grata in their homelands, they ended up in Britain, which welcomed them and in many cases lionized them, treated them very well. And this was very frustrating to some of these autocratic governments. And so in this real incident, evidently it was being staged by some foreign power that wanted to discredit the political refugees in Britain and get them expelled. So Conrad Wright wrote a novel about that. In the novel, there's a whole kind of cell of left-wing radical would-be terrorists in London, but they're not responsible for the act. Some guy named Vladimir at some foreign embassy is behind it, and Conrad absolutely hated Russia as a Pole at a time when there was no Poland. And so it's not said, but this is presumably Russia staging this. And so you have a story about a right-wing continental autocratic power staging a phony left-wing anarchistic socialist terrorist act. The way many literary critics have interpreted this is Conrad must be negative about all politics, because after all, he shows how evil the right wing is, has these nefarious purposes, but he doesn't present the left wing sympathetically. In fact, what he tends to show is the anarchists are accomplishing nothing. They're sitting around talking about it, but they never do anything. And the only one who does something is this weird character, Mr. Verloc, who's a triple agent. He appears to be working for the anarchists, but he's secretly in the pay of Vladimir and this foreign power. But secretly, he's an informant to the British police. So it's actually based on a guy named Azhov, who was evidently a triple agent, and at one point gave orders to assassinate himself in his capacity heading one organization. He gave orders to assassinate himself. It's an amazing story, but true. Anyway, so Conrad appears to, it's a plague on both your houses. The left-wing revolutionaries are no good. The right-wing autocrats are no good. I actually accepted that reading for many years until I sat down to rethink it, and I realized it was the fallacy of the excluded middle. that in fact Conrad is defending the political middle in the book. And the political middle is liberal England. It's 19th century liberal England, that it is in fact a defense of a middle class law-bound society in England against these two extremes, socialist anarchists who want to destroy it and the continental autocrats who want to destroy it. So people talk about the ineffectuality of everybody in this novel. And it's true. One of the hilarious things about it is the chief of the radicals, a man named Mikhailis. He's actually based on Mikhail Bakunin, the Russian anarchist. He's grown so fat that he can barely move. And it becomes emblematic of a left-wing radicalism that now enjoys its celebrity and is not accomplishing anything. But at the
heart... Sounds contemporary in some ways, yeah.
I'll get to that, actually, in a minute. But the hero of the book, and it has a genuine hero, is he's simply called the assistant commissioner. And he's a kind of Sherlock Holmes figure. Conrad was always trying to be successful commercially. Took him a while, but he imitated people like Kipling and H.G. Wells and Conan Doyle. He looked at what was selling and said, well, I'll try that. And so this assistant commissioner tracks down what has really happened by a clue. This I'm not going to reveal. Like Lord Jim, this has one of the greatest narrative turns in fiction history, and I won't spoil it, and I don't have to spoil it. I'll just say that through a Sherlock Holmes-like clue, he's able, within a couple of days, to unravel the mystery, go to this guy Vladimir and says, I know you did it, you leave the country, and I won't say any word of this. And he doesn't want to punish Vladimir, he just wants to crush the story, because he knows the aim was to make a big terrorist incident to get the British to change their policy towards continental refugees. He senses the political solution is cover up the story. Huh. And he has a way to do it. Huh. And it's legitimate the way, because they don't succeed in blowing up. I'll tell you that much. Mm-hmm. You may have noticed the observatory still. Yeah. They didn't, and in fact, they didn't blow it up. And in the story, they didn't blow it up. Something gets blown up. Read the novel. You'll find out. In fact, this assistant commissioner turns out to be brilliant. He solves the mystery and does it in such a way other people want to prosecute, they want to make a big deal of it, and he realizes we're playing into their hands if we play up the story. Just dissociate it from the Greenwich Observatory, keep it quiet, and this is the figure who emerges as heroic. He's a very ordinary middle-class English type who solves things by his rationality. Everyone thinks England is so stupid.
Right.
The left-wing revolutionaries think it's so stupid. The right-wing autocrats think it's so stupid. Why are they admitting these refugees? And they're so stupid. And they're not stupid. They know what they're doing. They believe in freedom, and in some ways they are defusing these terrorists by welcoming them. It's actually based on Bakunin famously escaped from a prison in Siberia. He wrote a book about it, became famous, lionized on television, the equivalent, then made a fortune actually off it. Well, maybe not a fortune, but made a lot of money off it. And in the novel, he has an aristocratic patroness. And in fact, it helps the assistant commissioner that the orders have come down. Mikhailis must not be involved. And he proves he's not involved. And I can show that. One of the great things about the novel that's so perceptive is it studies aristocratic socialism in England. There are two figures who are aristocrats who are very sympathetic to these left-wing radicals. One is this aristocratic patronage. The other is Sir Ethelred, the Home Secretary, also grotesquely fat, and a mirror image of these radicals. You had the guy at the top of the English hierarchy, Home Secretary, and then this radical. And Sir Ethelred is fostering through Parliament a bill for the nationalization of fisheries. A kind of perfect Hayekian image right. of government. And he's got this sycophantic sidekick who's called the revolutionary Toodles in the work, and we're revolutionary, yeah. you know. And what Conrad understands is the aristocracy actually backs socialism. It's very true in England, also in Sweden, by the way, that particularly shows with the aristocratic patriotism, she can't stand people who've made money.
Right.
I mean, she's had money. She wants to hold on. She can't stand the idea that other people are getting money now. So she sides with the revolutionaries who are opposed to capitalism. And Conrad really shows a brilliant understanding of this, that capitalism really is poised there in the middle between the extreme right and the extreme left. And it is preferable to either. And so you have this aristocrat in Parliament who's you know wants the government to take over the whole fishery business. And it's really very perceptive about what happened in England. Many of the people who supported nationalization of industries in the 19th century in general who were on behind the development of the welfare state were aristocrats who had contempt for this new power of the middle class
right.
and businessmen. And I think Conrad is a foreigner. Again, we think of him as this English author, but really he was a Pole. English was his third language.
Yeah,
French
amazing.
Was his second language. And I think his he had a kind of perspective, and this novel shows he understood what was happening in England in around 1900 better than any Englishman I know of at the time. So it is a remarkable novel. I mean, again, the plot is so sensational. I just can't even
And it also shows what mystery novels often do. I think that the system doesn't quite defend itself. I mean, it does need this person of ability who sort of
yes.
doesn't simply mechanically enforce the
yes.
law.
Yes, and in fact,
and makes a prudential yes. judgment about.
You're so perceptive there because there's a dumb cop in it as well.
Oh,
there's an Inspector Lestrade, Chief Inspector Heat, whose basic idea, as soon as he hears about the bomb, he wants to arrest all the radicals.
Right. So it needs,
just what Vladimir wanted. And he is slowed down. And indeed, it turns out. Heat is in cahoots with the criminals and with the radicals. It's this strange world in which the policemen are basically the mirror images of the people they're defending. And again, a central image is this triple agent Verloc, who, by the way, runs a soft porn shop as well. It just.
It's very amazing. Contemporary.
No, it's really amazing.
Soft porn is not contemporary.
Yeah, yeah. But and I haven't even talked about his wife. What you see in the novel is that the ordinary forces in England can't defend themselves. And Conrad makes a point, the assistant commissioner looks like a foreigner.
Oh,
and in fact, he's described in a way I think Conrad...
So it's like him.
Yeah,
himself.
It is like him. And,
yeah.
And he likes eating in Italian restaurants. So it's a little... It's as if, yeah, you have to be a little foreign
to
be able to understand these foreigners and defend your country against them. So there's a lot about the English establishment in the work that shows them as not knowing what they're doing. But, you know, it's like Sherlock Holmes, who
yeah.
is such a
outside
yeah, odd man out, and
yeah.
the outsider has to defend the middle.
Great.
Yeah, so.
It's kind of, I'm curious, I mean, when I was in high school, late high school and then college, you know, Conrad was a big deal, I would say, if you were sort of had pretensions to
yeah.
be slightly intellectual. You read
yeah.
some Conrad, at least, and one knew of, you know, the different works and
yeah.
some of the really famous, like Heart of Darkness or
yeah.
Secret Age. Am I wrong? I don't really follow this. I mean, he's less, I mean, read today, or at least, I mean,
I think,
sort of
no, he's very, very important in the Academy.
Oh, is he? Okay. Reassuring.
It's actually strange.
You agree that he's a very great novelist.
He may be the greatest novelist in English of the 20th century.
Really?
And now I get a lot of flack for that one. But James Joyce, eat your heart out. But I think he's really great. And it is funny, he didn't succeed commercially until he started writing bad novels late night, but he was very widely read. It's actually very funny, apropos of what you're saying. T.S. Eliot wanted an epigraph from Joseph Conrad in The Wasteland. As you may know, Ezra Pound edited for him. He said, "What the hell do you want an epigraph from this second-rate hack?"
And he
talked Eliot into taking out the epigraph from Conrad. But he's taken very seriously now. I mean, partially is because people have discovered his connection with imperialism. And so Heart of Darkness, everybody reads Heart of Darkness and learns to condemn it, according to Chinua Achebe's formula, and Lord Jim. So he is read an awful lot in college. I'd say Heart of Darkness is probably one of the five or six most read literary texts in college today.
That's good, even if they don't understand it maybe.
Well, it's worth reading Conrad, and frankly, I had lunch with Chinua Achebe once, and he said, "Conrad, great author, read him," even though he'd written this. That essay was for public consumption and to stir up controversy.
Okay, so Conrad, other 20th century authors who were friendly to liberty?
I'm going to go to Franz Kafka. And this is a bit strange, though not as I'm going to try to argue, because when I was growing up in the 50s, I mean, Kafka was this hot author. Everybody read Kafka, and man, was it ever metaphysical and existential.
Right.
I mean, Kafka was, everything was a religious allegory, or everything was a psychoanalytic parable. And I mean, that's all true. I mean, his works are incredibly deep and very complicated and ambiguous, and there were all sorts of ways to approach them. There's so much to find in the novels. But, you know, it's interesting, people are rethinking him, and realizing that he was an anti-state author, that so much of his writing is about the lack of liberty in 20th century life. Now, it's funny, just after we talked about doing this conversation, I saw this newspaper article on, there's a new statue of Kafka in Prague. It's by a man, I think the name is David Czerny. And the statue is evidently in front of City Hall, and the sculptor said, "I want people to think of Franz Kafka every time they're totally frustrated by a state employee."
Wow.
And that's in a way amazing, but it turns out that Central and Eastern Europeans have been thinking of Kafka all along that way.
Right.
In some ways, it was an English and American appropriation to create the metaphysical or philosophical Kafka. Again, I'm not denying that that's there. But an awful lot of his writing is about what it is to live in the 20th century in these great bureaucratic states. What is the trial about? By the way, that's Der Prozess in Germany, the process. It's about this process that you can get sucked into where, you know, in that case, you don't know what you're accused of, but you burn your whole life is destroyed.
And when does he write them? Just to orient people, when is...
Basically the second decade of the 20th century, 1915, 16, 17. And, you know, it's interesting, and we sometimes get thrown off by authors. What is Kafka? Is he a German author?
Right.
Well, he wrote in German, but he lived his life in Prague. Is he a Czech author? Well, he's an Austro-Hungarian author. When he wrote, the political unit he lived in was the Austro-Hungarian Empire, which what became Czechoslovakia, is now the Czech Republic, was part of. Prague was the second or third city in it, Budapest. Vienna, the first city, Budapest and Prague. And that was a notoriously bureaucratic outfit. It's kind of a, as you know, I'm very interested in Austrian economics, and it's no accident that really should be Austro-Hungarian economics. It was produced out of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and my favorite economist, Ludwig von Mises, wrote a book called Bureaucracy, and as I recall, he has one footnote in it about Austro-Hungarian bureaucracy where he said typically people would be charged with murder and with failing to register with the police at the hotel. And these were roughly regarded as equal crimes. I'm exaggerating, but Mises had lived with bureaucracy. Kafka lived with bureaucracy. He worked in an insurance company. He was a claims adjuster, basically. So very familiar with the bureaucratic world, what we'd call the office world. And that world turns us into insects. And so we get to Metamorphosis, his most famous story. And a lot of his stories deal with the dehumanization that comes from living in a modern bureaucratic world. I'd like to recommend two, particularly The Great Wall of China and In the Penal Colony. Great Wall of China is 1915, and it's a parable ostensibly of the Chinese Empire, but really is of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. It deals with what it was like to live in the southern corner of China when they were building the wall in the north. And it deals with, you get a message from the emperor, and in the story, there's so many layers of bureaucracy the message has to go through before it gets to you. And Kafka raises the possibility, you know, the emperor could be dead by the time you get the message. And it's all about what is it like to live in a world where you're getting these commands at a hundredth remove. You don't even know if the emperor is still in power. And you're told about building this wall, and it is totally irrational, as is true of the actual Great Wall. Most people think there's one continuous Great Wall. There were seven walls that were built, and it really wasn't continuous. And of course, it was a complete failure. It was meant to keep the Mongols out, and it became the flashpoint at which trade with the Mongols occurred, and they all got in anyway. It's a story about the irrationality of massive government works project. And indeed, it emerges in the story, they're building the wall to keep the Chinese in, right, not to keep the Mongols out. And they're building it as a project that can engage all these people in the state. That's a marvelous image of how the empire or the nation state uses these massive projects to control its population. It's a pretty short story, but amazingly powerful. And then the other work I'd recommend is In the Penal Colony. Again, it's just an astoundingly prophetic work. It's about a sort of nameless penal colony of some European power, most likely Devil's Island. They seem to speak French in the story. And it's about a punishment machine, which engraves the lesson you should be learning on your body. That is, if you're guilty of stealing, it engraves, thou shalt not steal, on your body. And it's a frightening image of what the state became in so many places in the 20th century. By the way, it's a very interesting illustration of Hannah Arendt's thesis in her book on the origins of totalitarianism, that totalitarianism started in the and genocide specifically in the colonies of Europe and then came back home. Mm. And that's the suggestion here. You know, it's in der Strafkolonie, in the, you know, the punishment colony, you do these awful things, but it's going to come back to haunt you. And it's about the guy that runs this thing, and the machine is getting creakier and creakier and doesn't work. And finally, he puts himself into it to have the punishment inscribed on him. And it's a nightmare image of the Nazi extermination camps, of the Gulag, of all these horrible things. And in particular, you know, our normal understanding is the state punishes people because they've done things wrong, and this is instrumental. It's supposed to set them right. But Kafka suggests that is the state. It's a punishment machine. They're punishing you for the sake of punishing you. And that has terrifying resonance with so many things that came later. Two of Kafka's sisters died in extermination camps. In some ways, it's a blessing he died in the 20s before this happened. But, he's right. It's true, World War I had started. But, it's the tail end of that optimistic vision of the future in Europe. And he sees these really horrible things on the horizon. In the Penal Colony, it's one of the most powerful stories I know of the 20th century. And I really do recommend it.
One of the relatively few authors, I guess, whose name becomes an adjective, an
everyday
adjective.
Yes, even appears in Breaking Bad, as you know, my favorite TV show. Kafkaesque is used.
It's an impressive achievement to become such a.
Yes, and it's.
I'm sure it oversimplifies and it distorts also.
Yeah, it's sad that he never lived to even have any signs of it.
Is that right?
Most of his works were unpublished when he died, and he asked his best friend Max Brod to destroy them. And fortunately, Brod
did not
broke his pledge to Kafka.
Good idea. Any other 20th century?
Well, I'm going to go with Tom Stoppard.
Okay. Moving to the present almost.
Yes. Our one living author.
Right.
Arguably the greatest living playwright, an extraordinary long and productive career, and a very varied career. But what many people don't know is that man was born Thomas Strausler. He was born in 1937 in Czechoslovakia. His father was a physician working for the Bata Shoe Company. They were Jewish, and Bata Shoe Company tried to get its Jews out in the late 30s and sent him to be safe to Singapore.
Yeah.
Bad move. And his father was killed by the Japanese. And his mother ended up in India and married an English military officer named Stoppard. And that's how we got Tom Stoppard. He seems the quintessential Englishman. You hear him speak. He's the great inheritor of Oscar Wilde and the witty tradition of English drama. Seems so English. In the late 1970s, he started to go back to his Czech roots. He refers to himself as a bounced Czech. He's the king of the puns. He got interested in the dissident movement in Eastern Europe and specifically in Czechoslovakia, met Václav Havel, championed Havel in the English-speaking world. And you start to see a number of
which influenced the other, or is it more
both ways? It worked both ways, but
I always had the impression they were friends and sort of allies.
But they were in some ways fully formed before they met. As I think about it, in some ways Havel had more of an influence on Stoppard because he opened up this issue of totalitarianism and Czech dissonance. And in the late 70s, he wrote a series of plays. The first one is Every Good Boy Deserves Favor, which
he's
is
Stoppard.
Stoppard, yes. Which is about the Soviet abuse of psychiatric hospitals. It's a play about a dissident and a genuine madman in the same psychiatric ward. And, of course, being Stoppard, we flip-flop as who's the madman, so on. But it was an attempt to expose this horrific practice in the Soviet system of using the psychiatric wards to imprison dissidents. Then wrote a television play called Professional Foul, which is a term out of soccer, and the play is a lot about football, English football. But it's about an English professor of philosophy who goes to a philosophy conference at Prague and gets drawn in to the Czech secret police doing surveillance on a philosophy graduate student. And it's a really interesting play because this guy's a professor of ethics, and he's never made a real ethical decision in his life. It's all this abstract stuff. He has a theory of ethics, but no ethics. Mm-hmm. And he discovers ethics when he has to lie to save the life of this grad student. Stoppard wrote a really weird thing called Dog's Hamlet, Cahoots Macbeth. I just wrote a long essay about it for the Review of Politics, and my title is Reality Check. It's very interesting because it's Stoppard uses Shakespeare in it, and just it's very difficult to explain, but I'll just say it juxtaposes a performance of Hamlet at an English boarding school with a performance of Macbeth in Prague in 1978 as a protest against the crackdown against the 68 generation. And it's very complicated, but essentially, Stoppard shows, Shakespeare is meaningless in England. They just don't have a clue. Hamlet, they're just going through the motions, they don't care. In Prague, it's become a life and death matter.
Wow.
And it's an amazing play because it's Macbeth, you know, the knocking at the gate, the famous knocking at the gate. Macbeth has killed Duncan, and someone shows up at the gate, and you hear this knocking. The play proceeds to that point, but it's the secret police knocking at the door. They're there to shut down this dissident production. It's an absolutely brilliant theater. It was actually produced at the Shakespeare Theater here in D.C. in February. Unfortunately, I couldn't get to it, but I saw it in Chicago once. And it's a fascinating play about how Shakespeare is taken seriously under tyranny, where it really counts for something politically. Whereas we've gotten too used to it. It's too easy to produce Shakespeare. It takes place at a boarding school. Yeah. Little kids put on Hamlet, and they don't even understand it. Anyway, but what I really want to talk about is Coast of Utopia. Which came out in 2002. Actually, Stoppard heavily revised it for the New York Lincoln Center production in 2007. But it's his War and Peace. It's his play about 19th century Russia with a cast of thousands. It's a trilogy. It's an enormous, sprawling work. But it is an analysis, ultimately, of what produced the Russian Revolution and communism and how horrible it was. Stoppard, he read Isaiah Berlin to write it, and it shows that it's about the problem of theory and practice, that it's specifically about Mikhail Bakunin, Alexander Herzen, Vissarion Belinsky, all these proto-revolutionaries. They were revolutionaries, in fact, tried in 48. And they wrote these revolutionary newspapers. The great joke of the plays is these guys can't run their own lives, and yet they want to run the whole world. They just screw up everywhere, particularly in their sexual relationships. They destroy their own families. Coast of Utopia, they're always on the way to Utopia. They are imagining this perfect world. And Stoppard sees that this is going to become real when it gets to Lenin and Stalin and people get to try out these things in the real world. By the way, Marx is a character in the play, a rather minor one. It's very interesting how it shows that there were so many varieties of left-wing thought, and the question of how Marx ends up on top in it. But it is a deeply anti-utopian play. it shows great sympathy for the characters, particularly Alexander Herzen. I mean, Stoppard really thinks of them as having good hearts. In fact, Herzen, he was illegitimate, and his father gave him the name Herzen because it's right. Good, the product of heart. But it shows it doesn't work, and in particular, it's a great attack on the idea of history, the Hegelian and then Marxist idea of history. It shows the tragedy that results when people think that life is governed by history and it's on a march towards progress and nothing can stop it and we just have to enlist in the cause of history. By the way, there's a bit of that in Conrad understands that as well because he sees the messianic nature of the theories of people like Michaelis in the novel. And it's actually an interesting connection between the Stoppard play and the Conrad novel is both works show that what the left can't deal with is contingency. It wants an absolute validation of a utopian situation that will come about as an inexorable product of history. So that it's very symbolic, as Conrad develops, the idea of blowing up the Greenwich Observatory, perfect act of terrorism because it would stop time. And stop that temporal element in human life that complicates things. My colleague Stephen Cox has written a wonderful essay on the secret agent that appears in a book he and I edited called Literature and the Economics of Liberty, in case you want to explore some other books that
absolutely
deal with it.
Absolutely should.
Yeah.
Yes.
He talks about how these characters can't deal with the contingency of human life, which is the great subject of novels themselves when they're well written. There's a wonderful book on the subject called Narrative and Freedom by Gary Saul Morrison. He celebrates Dostoevsky and Tolstoy for allowing their characters freedom, for allowing the plots to just develop without pre-planning and without trying to pigeonhole the characters, certain situations. It's that if you talk to novelists, they will often say, well, I didn't know what the character was going to do until I wrote the scene. And that sounds ridiculous, but it's true. It's true to many novelist experiences. And similarly, in the Stoppard play, what these people, they can't handle contingency. So one of the tricks of the work, it's a bit like Harold Pinter in Betrayal. The scenes do not appear in chronological order, and so we get the irony of seeing people ahead of time. We know how it's going to turn out, and then we see them planning the events, and they don't turn out according to plan. So it's actually interesting that if you put the Marxist view of history is extremely linear and one-directional. And I think Stoppard breaks down the normal linearity of drama to convey a vision of the world that's the opposite of that, that things just don't work out against plan. You know, they don't work out according to plans like who you're going to marry. But the people who experience that don't understand it. You can't plan the future of a country any better than you can plan your marriage or how your children are grow up. And the play is the Coastal Utopia is a lot about how contingency is a fundamental element of human life, which in a way takes us all the way back to Ben Jonson and this notion that central planning ignores the contingency and diversity of life, how strange things are, how unpredictable they are. That's the odd thing about many authors that in their desire to produce a story, they turn it into something so predictable and miss the fundamental fact about human life, its unpredictability. And a lot of these works I discussed today, I think, are works that recognize that contingent and unpredictable element in human life that makes it human and not just a product of abstract forces. The Coastal Utopia is wonderful. Stoppard identifies the intelligentsia, this Russian word that was coined for this new phenomenon. And he shows these people who think they're better than everybody else because they're smarter. They are smarter. These are smart people, Stoppard shows. But they think because they're smarter, they should run the life of everybody. And he actually shows, they're journalists, a lot of them. They're writing for magazines. They're trying to make a living off their wits. And it really is that new phenomenon. Actually, again, Conrad shows that to some extent in Secret Agent, this new phenomenon, product of the Enlightenment, university-educated people, again, genuinely smart, in many cases having an attractive vision of the human future, but in one way they're just trying to make a living off their ideas, and that becomes so dangerous. The danger of the intelligentsia is the great theme, Coastal Utopia.
You've given us more than enough to read and a wonderful commentary. I mean, one thing occurs to me, we didn't discuss this, but so none of the books, authors you recommended is American. So couldn't that be interpreted? In the era of Trump, I feel that that's, you know, a terrible slight. Is there, so off the top of your head, is there one American novelist?
Huckleberry Finn.
Twain is a friend of mine.
Yes. Okay. Though also understands potential dark side, but Huckleberry Finn is a great celebration of liberty in the great American tradition of lighting out for the frontier.
Well, we should have a separate discussion about American literature, right? Because they really are interesting, don't you think, trends both ways and among some of the greatest American authors.
Absolutely. Yeah. But the great American image of the frontier.
Yeah,
by the way, Kafka wrote his last novel was America, and it's a very bizarre vision of America. But it does show that America was a beacon of freedom in Europe, even Central Europe.
Oh, that's great. Well, that's a good note to end on. So, Paul, thanks so much for this extremely instructive and enlightening discussion. And
it was a pleasure discussing it with you.
Well, thank you. And thank you for joining us on Conversations.